Hello and welcome to the Contracting Officer Podcast. You're listening to the podcast for people who want to learn about the government market from the contracting officer's perspective. If you are a contracting officer, we hope to give you a little more insight into industry's perspective. Today's topic is, what is a contracting officer? We cover the FAR definition of contracting officers, how you get to be a contracting officer, and also explain all the different terms for contracting officer. Hope you enjoy it. Let's get started. Hey, Kevin. Today we're going to answer the question, what is a contracting officer?
The short answer is, a contracting officer is someone who spends our tax dollars. There's a much more complicated long answer behind that, but in reality, it's someone who is constitutionally authorized to buy goods and services for the U.S. government. So if they're buying something, something's being bought for the U.S. government somewhere, doesn't matter what agency, contracting officer is usually buying it. And we'll get into the nuance of how there are adjustments to that later. The long answer is that a contracting officer awards, administers, modifies, and terminates contracts. And you can look it up in FAR 1.6 if you really want to see the detail of it. But with what they get is a delegated authority. And what that means is that they're delegated this authority by the head of the agency. And that delegated authority, they may be able to award contracts worth $1 million, contracts worth $5 million, contracts worth an unlimited amount based on getting approvals. So that's the longer answer. But the short answer is, they spend our tax dollars. How's that?
That's perfect. The short answer was actually Kevin's short, so not super short.
That's true. I'm not known for being unverbose, if that's even a word. So what is a contracting officer, and why are CEOs leery of interacting with industry? And why do they take their time awarding contracts? And why do you hear the "it depends" answer so much? So in other words, let's dig in deeper into, you know, what really is a contracting officer? What are their authorities and those kind of things? So Now we get into the actual FAR reference here, because this is kind of fun. So for those of you who are driving, try and focus with me here. FAR 1.602. So Federal Acquisition Regulation, Part 1.602, right up front, they say a contracting officer, this is what they have to do. This is the standard by which a contracting officer is judged. They must ensure that all requirements of law, executive order, regulation, and all other applicable procedures, including clearances and approvals, have been met before they sign any government contract. So let's repeat that, because that's really fun, right? All laws, all executive orders, because we all read those every day. I mean, you know, we get a text from the president every day on the
easy to memorize.
Exactly, right? All the regulations, all the applicable procedures, which who knows how many there are, and then including all the clearance and approvals you have to get. So whenever a contracting officer signs a contract, and by the way, you want to read this, it's in FAR 1.602-1B. I mean, this is right out of the FAR. This is the standard. This is a far-reaching way to look at, oh, wow, a contracting officer is really responsible for basically checking every federal regulation before they spend our tax dollars. Yikes, right? So now that I've scared the crap out of you,
Put him to sleep by reading the FAR. I'm not sure which.
So basically the idea is that they got to check everything. Now, think of it. When you're a brand new contracting officer and you read that paragraph and you think, wow, I can't, it's effectively an impossible standard to meet, right? Well, here's the good news. The very next paragraph, FAR 1.602-2, for those of you following along with the FAR, which would be really a funny image, but it also says, in order to perform these responsibilities, contracting officers should be allowed wide latitude to exercise business judgment.
So that's where you get off just from reading the book to actually thinking. That's what separates contracting officers right there, is their ability to exercise that business judgment.
Correct. So on one hand, you have the far, far as in the adjective, the word, the far-reaching side of, this is a very disciplined, by the book standard. However, you have the other side of this is, but we expect you to use business judgment. So for those of you who wonder, well, why is that important? Well, the cool thing about that, that's what makes being a contracting officer interesting, is you're balancing those two. The one hard extreme, you know, think of it in the right brain, left brain kind of thing. You have the one side, it's the first part is the left brain. It's like, this is very logical. This is absolutely, you must follow the regs. And then the other side is the right brain, where you have to use and exercise business judgment. And that's why you get lots of different types of contracting officers. You get people like us who actually like this kind of work because there's so many variables within it. I mean, imagine you have this enormous, like, I don't know, what's the FAR up to? Probably 1,500 pages or something. And all these different regulations that come with it. But then you get to be allowed wide latitude to exercise business judgment, to put the puzzle together for every acquisition, for how are you going to buy this? As long as you're within those laws, there are lots of different ways you can do this. So, what this really comes down to is it gives the contracting officer the authority to judiciously choose from a wide variety of options. Yep. And this is really what makes a contracting officer fun, or being a contracting officer fun.
Right. So let's rewind a little and go back to that all applicable procedures, including clearances and approvals. And all applicable procedures doesn't just mean the FAR. There's levels and levels of regulations below the FAR, depending on where you work. So if you're in DOD, you not only have the FAR, but you have the DFARs, the Defense Federal Acquisition Regulations. Then you have agency-specific supplements that get down to the nits of how things are done and approved at your agency. And depending on where you are, there may even be lower-level supplements below that. So it's not just one 1,500-page book that you have to follow. It could be multiple books, and hopefully they get smaller as they go down.
That's true. And you're right. The regulations, the FAR supplements do get smaller over time, but they're still not teeny. We'll have to come up with a screencast for this, but for those of you who are curious, if you go to the FAR site, which is FAR site, let's see, I think it's farsight.hill.af as in Air Force .mil. So yep. It's a Hill Air Force base. Anyway, or just Google U.S. government FAR site. Anyway, on this site, and again, we'll have to come up with a screencast for this. On the site, you'll see across the top, there are all the different logos for all the different agencies, like the Department of Energy and the Department of Defense and the Health and Human Services and Department of Homeland Security and Transportation, all those guys. If you hover over each one of those, you'll see that it links to their supplement to the FAR. And here it gets even more fun that you get below the agency level and you end up with, for example, Special Operations Command has their own. So if you're a contracting officer at Special Operations Command, you have the FAR, the main one, the one that applies to everybody in the federal government. Then you have the Department of Defense one. And then you have the Special Operations Command supplement.
So how do you become a contracting officer? Contracting officers are appointed by their agency head or a designee. And in my experience, it's usually the top acquisition or contracting person is the one who gets to appoint who has authority below them. The agency head themselves doesn't usually do that, but I've worked in large agencies where there's many levels between those positions. At a small place, maybe the agency head does maintain that authority, but where you and I grew up at Wright Pat, where we started to do that, the director of contracts for the command was the one who issued the warrants, right?
Correct. And that the authority to issue that warrant comes down, again, you go up high enough, comes down through the Constitution, and then it ends up going to the Department of Defense, and then it comes down to the Air Force, and then it's delegated to down through the all the different nuts and bolts down to this individual who's, say, a GS-15 or an SES or somebody who's a director of contracts for that particular department. And that's the person that gives you the warrant. But let's zoom out here. This all goes back to, this is a constitutionally authorized way for us to spend tax dollars.
You're allowed to spend money.
That's a big deal.
And the process for how you're appointed, it's not always the same. And it's not transferable from agency to agency. If you had a warrant at one agency and then went to work for another agency, they might not just hand you a warrant when you walk in the door. So the process to be considered a contracting officer isn't always easy or quick. You have to prove yourself, and they have to know you before they hand you the authority to obligate the government. So your experience, your training, your education, your overall judgment as perceived by the appointing officer, these are all things that are considered on whether or not you have a chance to become a contracting officer. And there's training classes that you have to complete before you're allowed to be selected too. That's another little FAR nit.
And something else to consider here is that like you said, it's different from each agency, and it's necessarily different because some agencies spend a whole lot of money. Some agencies don't spend as much. So many have Some agencies have 800 contracting officers. Some have 16. I mean, there's a lot of different animals. So, for example, to get a warrant at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, there are a lot of, what happens to be that's a headquarters for one of the acquisition offices there. So there are a lot of people, a lot of contracting people there, and a lot of humongous programs. Like when you're buying an F-22 or a B-2, you're spending a lot of money, right? So in order for you to spend that kind of money, you're going to have the people giving you that authority to do so are going to need a whole lot more trust in that you know what you're doing, right? And so not necessarily linear just to the amount of money that you spend, but realistically, how many other contracting people are there? So at a smaller base, what that means is that it may not be as complicated to get your warrant.
Right. And so then it goes into, that's a perfect lead into that the level of authority that you're given. So contracting officers are appointed in writing on a specific form, a certificate of appointment, which the appointing officer has to sign it, and it tells you how much authority you have. So you might have $500,000. You might be able to sign a contract or buy something worth $500,000 without any further approvals. It might be $1 million. It might be $5 million. It might be unlimited. And depending on which agency you work for, unlimited may be the rule because there's so few contracting officers. You may go through stages of a career where you're given a limited, very limited warrant to start with, and as you gain experience and trust, your delegation goes up until you're eventually an unlimited warrant contracting officer. It's done differently in each place I've worked, at least. I'm sure for you too, Kevin.
Yeah, and I'm sure it's done differently in each agency. For example, when I went to Patrick Air Force Base, it just happened to be at the time they didn't have a warrant board process. And a warrant board means that the contracting officer warrant, you sit before a panel and they ask you questions and basically test your judgment. Your
business. Like the Inquisition.
Yeah, that's depending on the size of the board, it can feel like that. But it just coincidentally, I happened to be in the position of writing the policies behind it, because I worked in the policy office there for about 8 months.
Ooh, policy.
Coincidentally, I ended up doing being one of the people that sat on the board for my warrant for the policy that I wrote. So it was kind of ironic how that played. But not every agency has a warrant board. Some do, some don't. So the point of this exercise is that different agencies are going to have different procedures, and that's important to understand because it's delegated through agency procedures. So that's why, here's the reason you care. That's why an Air Force contracting officer with 10 years experience is probably just going to have, they've been exposed to more things than someone who worked in a smaller, like the Railroad Retirement Fund. He's not buying as much stuff. He doesn't have 50 other contracting officers to talk to. He just doesn't have, he or she doesn't have as much exposure to things. So when you kind of figure out why are contracting officers different, this is one of the reasons, is that it's not a blanket standard that applies to the whole U.S. government.
Right.
It's by agency procedures.
Right. So now I want to take a minute and explain why COs are, we use the term CO, but you'll hear all kinds of different terms. You hear PCO, ACO, TCO to describe different, what that does is it describes different types of contracting officers and what they do. PCO is procuring or procurement contracting officer. ACO is administrative contracting officer. TCO, terminating contracting officer. PCO is the person that's out there buying things, doing source selections. Administrating contracting officers have authority delegated to them to do certain functions, and it's either delegated by the regulations or specifically in writing that they can be delegated certain functions. And they take care of, after the contract is issued, they take care of managing it and modifying it as a long-term program goes along. And if you're just buying commodities, there's usually not an ACO. You might not even hear those terms. You just hear CO.
Yeah. And an example of an ACO is like a $1 billion program that I worked at in Colorado Springs that we awarded the contract. We managed the obligation of funds for doing the phased array radar work. But as far as managing the contract and making sure that the earned value management systems were working, making sure that, the contractor was getting paid on time, making sure we were getting credits for early payments, making sure that all of the reports were being done, they were actually, in some cases, in the plant. So the administrative contracting right. officer was delegated the authority to manage the contract after I put stuff on it.
Right.
So hopefully that makes it a little bit clearer. But you're right. That's a term that most people wouldn't even hear if you're not working on something that's $500 million contract.
Right. And the last one I mentioned, TCO, terminating contracting officer. Specifically, if a program's going badly and requires prolonged negotiations to terminate and come to a termination settlement, someone might be given a title of a terminating contracting officer where all they do is go through that termination.
So, and one thing to add to the TCO is that the reason that you have kind of a specialized person for that is that FAR Part 49, which is all about terminating contracts is not easy, and it normally isn't cheap for either side. So it's not something that you do very often. So for example, combined, you and I have 30 years of experience in contracts, and I never actually terminated a contract. I threatened to a couple of times because of performance issues, but I never actually terminated one. So that what they found, and that's the reason that the TCO was kind of developed, and there probably aren't that many of them. In fact, I think there were like maybe one or two people that did this at Wright-Patterson. It's a specialized skill, and if you have a lot of contracts and you potentially have to be terminating them on a regular basis, you want somebody who specializes in it. So, but more often than not, that's just not somebody you're going to run into. And quite honestly, if you're having good contracts, it's not somebody you're going to need. So.
To add to the confusion, sometimes a contracting officer is called a KO instead of a CO. Well, why is that?
So those of you who are Army, you understand that CO means commanding officer. So the simple explanation is that certain agencies, for example, Army and Special Operations Command, refer to what we call a CO.
There's already a CO. It was used.
Exactly. It was already taken. You know, they had dibs on that. So now the reason this is important is that if you're approaching a contracting officer at, say, Special Operations Command, and you refer to them as a CO, you obviously don't know their agency very well. So, and by the way, that's what I did. When I first showed up there and coming from the Air Force, the terms I grew up with was CO.
Yeah.
So just as a heads up that you need to know the difference, particularly if you're targeting an agency and showing that you know their stuff.
All right. Another naming thing that you may hear contracting officer. Instead of that, someone may be referred to as a contracting specialist or a contract specialist or a contract negotiator or even a buyer. And what that means is that they're a contracts professional, but they don't have a warrant. They don't have the authority to obligate the government by themselves. So that's what you start at. When you enter the field, you're usually a contract specialist or a contract negotiator. And you do all the same things, but you don't actually sign the contract. So not everyone that has authority to buy has to be a contracting officer, right?
Correct. And one of the ways that government is trying to simplify the acquisition process, say it that way, is through what's called a micro purchase. And a micro purchase is normally below $3,000. So in other words, that's a government credit card. If somebody has a government credit card, they walk down to, I don't know, Staples, and they're buying a desk. You know, it's stupid examples, but those are the kind of things that the government employees and active duty military are actually encouraged to get this delegated authority. So while on one hand, the cynical side of that is, well, that's the stuff that makes the news. You know, that's the story of the guy that went and bought himself a diamond ring for $2,000 with his government credit card. Okay, that stuff happens. And that's unfortunate. But the reality is that for the thousands and thousands of people.
He probably didn't buy himself a diamond ring. Maybe bought it for an engagement ring. You know, anyway, go on.
Bad example. I'm off my game today with my analogies. But the idea is that there's just so many things the government buys that is under $3,000 that it's just much more efficient to use a government credit card and just risk the fact that, okay, we're going to have a little bit of waste there. And I know that as a taxpayer, that kind of makes you cringe. But I mean, think about it. We're talking billions of dollars here.
Right.
So like 1% or even a thousandth of a percent of $1 billion is what it would cost to manage this. Because here's the other way this used to go. Before government credit cards, that meant if you wanted to buy a box of pencils, you had to have a contracting officer do it. So imagine how you were talking about government being slow. That would really be slow.
Right.
So now they've made it much more efficient. So this is one of the ways that the contracting environment has gotten more efficient. So smaller purchases can be made by government credit card.
Yeah, now, there's still a lot of oversight for government credit cards, though. It's not like you just go out and buy what you want and the bill gets paid. You never have to justify anything. There's still work that has to be done for it. So it's not a complete free-for-all, but it is a lot quicker.
Correct. And in fact, when I worked at Wright Patterson, one of the guys in my office, his job was to review all the government purchase card transactions.
Yeah, I had that job once. Did not enjoy it. Couldn't wait to get rid of that.
But this is an example of it, one of the areas of your industry, and what you sell is, okay, here's a real example. We bought plaques for people when they were retiring or moving to their next office, right? There was a plaque shop right outside of the base. And we would go to that shop, and with the government credit, I mean, we're talking like $60 for a plaque. I mean, it's a custom plaque. It's not a standard thing. It's got their name on it, that kind of cool. It's got the cool logos from where they worked. But that's a government credit card they're using for that. So the reason this is important is for those people who are out there who sell that kind of stuff and are looking to get into the government market, understand where you are. If you're selling things that people can buy with a government purchase card, then you going to the contracting officer to try and get a 5-year contract through a source selection, that's not where you need to be. So this is a nuance you could almost have in a whole other podcast about micro purchase processes. Right. But just for the purposes of this meeting or this conversation, the important thing to understand is that purchases under $3,000 can be made by people who have who've been delegated to do that through usually a government purchase card.
Right.
Well, that wraps up today's session. So really the overview today was about understanding what is a contracting officer from the FAR definition, what is the strict regulatory concept behind it, but also how are they appointed? How do you get to be a contracting officer? What are the selection criteria, those kind of things? And then also to really help everybody understand the difference between the different types of names for contracting officers, ACOs, PCOs, contract specialists, et cetera. And we could turn, like everything else we talk about, we could turn this into a 2-hour podcast with every nut and bolt there is out there. But this is the high level perspective on what a contracting officer is. And if you have more questions about it, send them in and we will answer them because that's why we're here.
Great. I'll talk to you later, Kevin.
Thanks.
That's it for What is a Contracting Officer? If you have questions, comments, or complaints, please send us a note at paul@contractingofficerpodcast.com or kevin@contractingofficerpodcast.com. Or just start a discussion at the Contracting Officer Podcast on LinkedIn so everyone can play along. Thanks for listening.